Please join me in welcoming an American hero and a fine artist, Reginald Dwayne Betts.
Thank you guys for coming. It is quite a pleasure to be here. One, because I'm reminded that I am past the toddler stage. And as cute as little man is, I like the fact that he's over there in the corner. He was like reading the program. Like, as cute as he is, I'm just not. My knees hurt. Can't chase children. So I'll read a few poems, and since we're going to have a conversation, I'll try to keep the reading down to about if absence was the source of silence, some things my sons would never hear, not from my reluctance to speak, or the thief that has silenced his mother's tongue, his grandmother's tongue, turned the stare of the woman who, when it's far too early for the sun to be out, sees me turn a corner with a Newport, the sky and the ground as dark as the fear in yesterday's. She swallows as she crosses into what might as well be oncoming traffic. If absence was the source of silence, some things my sons would never hear, not for my reluctance to speak, or the thief that has silenced his mother's tongue, his grandmother's tongue, turned the stare of the woman who, when it's far too early for the sun to be out, sees me turn a corner with a Newport, the sky and the ground as dark as the fear in yesterday she swallows as she crosses into what might as well be oncoming traffic. Remembering a man from her past. Stories my sons would not know, not because of a need to hide history. Those bedrooms and ballrooms and work where trust became carnage. No, these things would be Pandora's box untouched. And yet, they will know. Because. And the because is what I tell my sons about what their hands might do. In long conversations of what the hands of men do, their hands, my own. When I was 12, a friend told me of men offering her money for her slender and young body. When I was 12, a friend told me of men offering her money for her slender and young body. She no older than me then, arms not strong enough to carry her own weight, let alone push her past the men who wanted to own what is hers. Hers, just the first of a story that would return and keep returning, that numbered hurt. Rape is aftermath, and this account of trauma my boys would never know if the world differed. If war did not mean soldiers of a woman as land to be plundered. I keep trying to turn this into some kind of sense. For me, my sons will hear a story about how hands like theirs, like mine, made something wretched of the memories of women we love or don't know at all. This is true. And there is a map to take us to all that hurt. Some silence saying it all, but let's say the world is ours. On that day, all the silent tongues will have speak without fear of being doubted. Of the cars and hellos that became dungeons, of friends who became the darkness that drowns all into there is only rage and sadness. And maybe after, we can build memory that does not demand silence. All the things that happen now, as if a part of being would not be. And my sons' lives will be carved out of days in which their hands and bodies do not suggest weapons. Days where all their mothers and sisters can walk down any street in this world with the freedom that comes from knowing you will be safe. After dusk, or during those moments just before dawn, unlike today and yesterday and now, when the quiet and what might ruin it is the threat that circles. This next poem, I gotta apologize for not reading longer, I actually made a request to the Boston Book Festival that I get to read the entire book to you guys. They found out that it would take me 2 hours and 26 minutes to read the whole thing, and they promptly said no. But they said that you could buy the book in lieu of me reading the whole thing to you. And they even said, if I produce an audio book, I could tell you about it. So there is an audio book. As I read this next poem, I just want to make two statements to sort of frame this book and frame my presence here and why it's quite complicated. My book is called Felon. And one of the reasons why I called the book Felon is because I wanted to confront all of the things that we've done and what we think about people based on the things that they've done. There are many people who I respect, who I trust, like call me formerly incarcerated, call me a returning citizen. I'm good with you calling me a convict. I'm good with you knowing that I am a felon. I'm more than that. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a basketball coach. We went undefeated last year, you know. I'm many things, but I carjacked a man who was asleep in his car. And I need you to know that and know that I moved beyond that and trust that just because I did that shouldn't stigmatize me for the rest of my life. But more importantly, I wanted to write a book that expressed the broad range of experiences and emotions that people who have criminal convictions deal with. I wanted to write a book that challenged me to think about the kind of hurt I've done and the kind of hurt people I know have done. Now, one of the things with that is making a decision about, is the book, is the poem, are these going to be in first person and second person and third person? What kind of distance will I have from the pain and the harm that I've caused and the other people who I know have caused? And I decided that if I made myself proximate to these things, I might encourage a conversation that was meaningful, even if the conversation only happened in my own head. And so what happens is, it's a lot of poems in this book about domestic violence. What happens is, there's a lot of poems in this book about sexual assault. There's a lot of poems in this book about what it means to mistreat people that you love. And all of them are in the first person. And so then what happens is every time I read from the book publicly, I have to have a conversation with people in the room about why I did that. And my answer is never satisfactory to myself. But at the end of the day, the reason why I did it is because when you go home and you read this book, I imagine that you won't read it and think about me. You'll read it and think about somebody you know who did these things I speak of. And hopefully, as we read this book and we have these conversations, we'll figure out how to address the harm while actually seriously considering the fact that we incarcerate too many people. And I'm going to read the last poem. And all of these are a combination of fact and fiction. But it is always troubling for me to read the last poem. So, there you have it. It's a housekeeping notes that are absolutely irrelevant unless you're a writer or you really like to know cool shit about. Ooh! So he's not going to repeat that word. Young folks over here, don't repeat any word that has four letters. You know, or five. So what you'll find is this is a crown of sonnets, so the last line of one crown of one sonnet becomes the first line of the next. And this is the last poem I'll read. So here we go. One more thing. The first sonnet is after a poem by George Herbert called Prayer One. And that poem is a sonnet, and it's just defining what prayer is. It's a poem that has no verb in it. It's just a lot of phrases for what prayer means to this poet. So this first sonnet is about ways for me to think about prison. So they're all phrases that define prison. So if you hear it and you're like, what is going on? That's what's going on. The last note for people who don't read poetry a lot is you should not feel compelled to remember everything I say. If you find yourself thinking about something in the second sonnet and you don't hear the next three, just get joy in thinking about what you were struggling with in that second one. Because too often we approach poetry as if it's a fuck. I did that for you guys. I wanted to see if you were paying attention, really. Now, too often we approach poetry as if it's a test. And you won't be quizzed after this. I want you to approach this with some kind of joy, right? All right. House of Unending. One. The sinner's bouquet. House of shredded and torn Dear John letters. Upended grave of names. Moon black kiss of a pistol's flat side. Time blueborn and threaded into a curse. Lazarus of hustlers. The picayune spinning into beatdowns. Breath of a thief stealed by fluorescent lights. A system of 40 blocks. Empty vials. A handful of purple cranes bills. Memories of crates suspended from stairs. Tied in knots around street lamps. The house of unending push-ups. Wheelbarrows and walking 20s. The daughters chasing their father's shadows. Sons that upset the wind with their secrets. The paraphrase of fractured. Scarred wings flying through smoke. Each wild hour of lockdown, hunger time, and a blackened flower. Two. Of lockdown, hunger time, and a blackened flower, ain't nothing worth becomes home. The cell, a catacomb that cages, and the metronome tracking the years that eclipse you. History authors your death, throws you into that den of lost hours. Your mother blames it all on your X chromosome, blames it on something in the blood. A styrofoam cup filled with whiskey lead you to court disfavor, to become drunk on count time and child call logic. There is no name for this thing you've become. Convict, prisoner, inmate, lifer, yard bird, all fail. If you can't be free, be a mystery, an amnesic, anything but a void succumbing to the humdrum, swallowing a bullet or even just choosing to inhale. Three, swallowing a bullet or even just choosing to inhale. Both mark you, pistol or the blunt to the head escorting you through the night. Your yell, an omen. The memories, the depression, the dead, and how things keep getting in the way of things. When he asked you for the pistol and you said no, the reluctance wasn't about what violence brings. His weeping in your ears made you regret what you owed. On some days, the hard ones, you cursed the phone. The people call and collect, reaching out, all buried, surrounded by bricks. On some days, you've known you wouldn't answer. The blinking numbers as varied as the names of the prisons holding on to those lives. Holding on, ensuring that nothing survives. I should just say this one thing that's apropos of nothing. Except what you don't hear in prison are children running around in a circle. And I know men who have done 20 years in prison who have never had a visit. Now, if you go to the visiting room, you hear children. You hear laughter. You'll see family members conversing, conversating, if you will, because I like conversating as a better word than conversing, really. But you won't hear children in a prison. And so what I find astonishing as I watch him run around and laugh and make noise is that he has allowed to disappear for so many people. And I hope people in this room, when they hear him laughing, juxtaposed with these stories I tell, recognize that his laughter and his running around is what gives urgency to my voice. Four, holding on, ensuring that nothing survives, not even regret. That's the thing that gets you. Holding on to memories like they're your archives, like they're there to tell you something true about what happened. My past put a skew on how I held her. Unaccustomed to touch, I knew only dream and fantasy. Try to see through that mire and find intimacy. It was just so much. And then the yesterdays just become yesterday, a story that you tell yourself about not dying. Another thing when it's mentioned to downplay. That's what me and that woman did trying to love each other. What kind of fool am I? Lost and was gone, reinventing myself with lies. Five. Lost and was gone, reinventing myself with lies. I walked these streets ruined by what I'd hide. Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. I barely see my daughters at all these days, out here caught up, lost in an old cliche. But tell me, what won't these felonies betray? Did a stretch in prison to be released to a cell, return to a freedom penned by Orwell? My new temptation is now the metro's third rail. In my wallet, I carry around my daguerreotype, a mugshot, no smiles, my name, a tithe. What must I pay for being this stereotype? The pistols I carried into the night, my anchor, the crimes that unraveled me, my banner. Six. The crimes that unraveled me, my banner. Only a fool confesses to owning that fact. Honesty, a sinkhole. The truth, doomed to subtract everything but prayer, turn my breath. Whiskey after prison made me crave amber. Brown washing my glass until I'm smacked. The murder of crows on my arm, an artifact of freedom. Would outlast even the jailer. Alas, there is no baptism for me tonight. No water to drown all these memories. The rooms in my head keep secrets that indict me still, my chorus of unspoken larcenies. You carry that knowledge into your twilight and live without regret for your guilty pleas. Seven. And live without regret for your guilty pleas. Mornings, I rise twice. Once for a count that will not come, and later with the city's wild birds who find freedom without counsel. I left prison with debts no honest man could pay. Walked out imagining I lacked my troubles. But once a girl said no to my unlistening ears, dismayed that I didn't pause. Remorse can't calm those evils. I've lost myself in some kind of algebra that turns my life into an equation that zeroes out regardless of my efforts. Algophobia means to fear pain. I still fear who knows all I've done. Why regret this thing I've worn? The sinner's bouquet, house shredded and torn. Thank you. Just us.
Yeah. That was amazing. It's quite a book of poems. Reading it, every poem felt hard, technically hard, emotionally hard. It just felt hard. And I wondered what was hardest for you about writing this book.
Yeah, I think sometimes, for a writer maybe, it's this thing where, you know, you drive a car, you get in a car, and you don't ever think that you want to build a car, right? But the car is this beautiful thing, and then once you figure out how to build the car, that's where all of the difficulty comes. But you still know that you're creating this thing that you at least find beauty in. So that's how I think about the poem, right? So it's a layer of difficulty that I invited into the work that's based on form, that's based on structure, that's based on what I expect the content to be when I approach the poem. But all of those things allow the emotional work of the poem to be not less difficult, but almost as if it happens with my mind not steadily focused on it. Like, you know, I'm writing this sonnet and I'm thinking, hold up, let me make this rhyme scheme legit. You know, let me make sure, like, how do I traverse through, because I was not trying to brag, but you got like the Shakespearean, the Petrarchan, the other dude, you know, you got the blues sonnet. Like, I'm trying to like flex and show that I got a facility with things I can't even name. And so like trying to do that, it becomes a distraction because I'm thinking about that as I'm also working through the actual emotional landscape
of all of the poems. And by doing that, I end up getting to places that I didn't expect to get to and maybe didn't even want to get to, but the poem kind of demanded it, or the book demanded it.
There are two forms in here that really stood out to me. One was the opening poem as a ghazal, right? A Persian, Arabic, traditional form. How did you pick that form? And it is like an amazing...
That form is like my obsession. When I was in prison, I read the work of Aga Shahid Ali, and he was like the,
country without a post office.
Yeah. And he called me Ishmael tonight, and I think that he really like revitalized the interest in the form, but also he just brought so much to it in terms of how to think about like country and home and love and loss, and emphasizing that structurally, getting it right matters. You know, knowing that it's this phrase that repeats and a word before it rhymes matters. And so again, it just became a thing like building a, like fixing a toilet, really. You know, like if you call a plumber and the plumber that know like what tool to use to like, I know you tried to cut your own, maybe you haven't, but I once tried to cut the water off on my toilet and I couldn't figure out what to do. And I'm like trying to turn the handle upside down and I'm opening the thing. And I ain't never felt more ignorant in my life. And I caught, you know, so like the ignorance isn't helping the situation at hand. And when you have to call somebody to say, how do you cut the water off in the toilet? That is a sad, sad moment, right? But I think about poetry the same way. You know, I'm trying to be the cat that knows how to turn the water off. And so looking at how he cared about the form and the structure and how he recognized that that made, you know, it's beautiful even if you don't know those things. But part of the reason why it's beautiful is because he knows it. And so that's why, like, I gravitate to that particular form. And also, his name is Aga Shahid Ali. And I had already been calling myself Shahid in prison when I met him through his work. And I like the word because I'm in prison. I'm thinking, you know, you're 16, you're about to do this decade in prison. What will you be? And I said, I'll be a writer. And then I ran into these cats that were all changing their name. And changing your name became a way to assert who you wanted to be in the world. And so when I was deciding what I wanted the people would call me, I picked Shahid because it means the witness. And so also in the ghazal, you get to sign your name at the end. And it's like a way to also like always reaffirm this thing that I imagine is what I'm doing. And even like what I'm doing here, you know, part of witnessing is ownership too. If the only way you witness is by saying what everybody else is doing and removing yourself from it, I think it's something problematic with that. And so even being able to sign as Shahid was a way to reaffirm this thing that I believe I continue to do, which is just to be a witness.
I just am thinking about that in the context of a lot of the poem is called Felon, right? And you've written elsewhere that the OED describes one of the definitions of a felon is a villain or a monster, right?
Yeah.
And so why did you, why, talk us through a little bit about the power of that word.
Yeah. Well, OED ain't Jesus, you know, for his Sunday, you know. OED is not my God. You know, OED is a reference point. OED is a marker of what humanity decided to say when they use these words to describe people. And I think I used it to really run into that. The sad thing, though, is I spent my whole life not wanting to be defined by the word felon and by prison and by my incarceration. And then I got out of prison and spent much of my life making it the center of the work that I do. And this book is triumphant and that ruin in the sense that if you Google the word felon, like my name comes up. But it's like, you know, but then again, it's this strange beauty to that too, because I think the argument that I'm making is that we are more than the worst thing that we've done. Mm. And to be more than the worst thing that we've done doesn't mean that we have to deny the worst things that we've done. I mean, in fact, to be more than the worst things that we've done, we have to be willing to really talk about it and think about it and I'll figure out how to address all of those harms and society, thinking about how society pushes us to some of these moments. And so calling the book Felon was, it was like my rejection of respectability politics. it was my ability to say, you know, when I lived here before, I moved here in 2011, it changed my life profoundly. I came here for a fellowship at Harvard, and it was supposed to be the height of the world for me, right? Because we were struggling before then. I mean, I was like, shit, I don't know how I'm going to pay rent next month. I don't know how me and my wife, I'm like, I don't know what we're going to do. And then I get this fellowship, and I'm like, this is great. Now, Harvard is paying me a bunch of money. I can say I'm a Radcliffe Fellow. And like 2 or 3 months into it, I'm thinking I can't get another job. I came for an interview here in Roxbury somewhere. Actually, it was kind of interesting because the people said, we would love to hire you, but you sound like a professor. And I was like, damn, that is the most kind and generous no I've ever received. But you know, I am not a professor. I appreciate it, but you know, nobody is paying me to be a professor. And then citizen school, I got to the finals of that job, and I got hired. And I said, you know, I got a criminal record. And they said, yeah, that's what makes you so good at this job for us. You had an experience. You could connect to people. You would be great. And then 3 weeks later, they said, well, we can't hire you because we're having a problem with your background check. And I was like, my background check? Google is my damn background check. You know, it's nothing that's being hidden. Didn't get that job. And I was just so distraught and frustrated, and so I just decided to go to law school. And the point is that this makes no sense, right? But the point is that I was like, I would much rather be an unemployed, like Harvard-trained lawyer than an unemployed poet. And, but I say all that to say, like, my life profoundly changed here. And being able to respect the respectability politics, or being able to respect the stigma that comes with the word felon, is really part and parcel with, like, having struggled a lot, but also having accomplished enough that, like, I people know me. So if you read one of these poems and say, man, Dwayne is assaulting his wife, he's a domestic abuser, and I'm okay with people feeling that way, but I hope when they read it, they think about people that they love, they think about people that they care about. But I'm good because I know the people who love me and care about me recognize that, like, that's not my narrative, and know that if they thought it was my narrative, they would be like, yo, bro, we need an intervention. Let's talk about this. What's going on? You know, and so, like, that's why I could call it felon, because I could try to embrace the worst instead of running from it.
And rename it, in a sense. Give it a different meaning, or?
No, it still means you committed a crime.
Yeah.
It still means you committed a crime that's characterized as a felony by the state. I don't think we're not going to turn felon into a nickname. It's just a noun, though. It doesn't have to be the only noun that you are, you know what I mean?
You have 4 poems in this book, with the same title, Essay on Reentry.
Yeah, and it's like 4 phases of trying to figure out what it means to come home. You know, one is about, you know, my kid learned that my oldest son learned that I've been in prison when he was 5. His classmate told him, and that was like devastating. Because he was just like, Dad, you know, he was crying. I'm like, the fuck you crying for? You know, it happened to me. I'm sorry, don't quote me on that. And I came, and when he came home and we talking, he asked me what happened. I said, yeah, I took somebody's car. He was like, did you have a gun? I was like, kinda. You can't really kinda have a gun, you know. And he looked at me, I was like, yeah, I had a gun. And he was like, but yo, bad people go to jail. And what devastated me is my 5-year-old is suddenly having to grapple with, like, my kid loves me. You know what I mean? And he's having to grapple with, like, how can you be a bad person to be my dad? And it was rough trying to, like, deal with that. And so we had decided that we would better protect our youngest. And we would tell him when he was ready. And then I'm getting sworn into the bar. I'm standing up. They swear me in. I turn around and address the audience. You're not supposed to really address the audience in court. Only the judge gets to talk, right? Unless you're about to go to jail. If you're about to go to jail, they let you talk as like a gift. But usually only the lawyers talk, right? But I turn around and I address the court and my mom is there. And it hit me. And I'm like, you know, the last time I was in a courtroom like this, I got sentenced to 9 years in prison. And my dad straight up and like sat in his brother's lap and like whispered something in his ear. I was like, damn. And so one of the essays on reentry is about that night, you know, telling him again, having to like tell him and talk to him, because when it happened, it was so much going on. And then he just had to sit with it for hours and hours, right? And then the other ones are different variations of that. You know, it's different things that you confront having committed a crime. It's like dealing with the fact that people know you committed a crime, your mom knows you committed a crime, dealing with the fact that you come home and your felonies become a kind of North Star that seem to direct where your future would be, except it's not taking you to freedom, it's taking you back to prison. And then another one is a poem for friends of mine who are still locked up. And I consider that poem to be like one of the most hopeful in the book, because they were saying that my man Fess was saying that he was sitting at the table and noticing that, you know, my man Star had gray in his beard, and that my man Juvie had gray in his beard, and that his head was bald and he had grays in his goatee. And he was like, it made him think about the time. And I thought that he was about to say it made him think that they were losing their lives in prison. But what he said is, it made me realize that we got a lot of, he said, looking at the landscape of gray that had become us. And I just thought that was such a beautiful phrase for a dude that ain't fucking graduate from high school. You know, and I was just like, this is what we locking away. But then he said, though, which was even more beautiful for me, he said, I realized that we had a lot of living left to do. And it was stunning to me. And it made me have a lot of faith in the Bernie Sanders campaign. Not because I'm supporting Bernie Sanders or acknowledging support for any presidential candidate, but because some black dudes in prison see him running for president, and they like, yeah, I'm a little bit 100 too. And I feel real good about that.
Your boys are pretty present in many of the poems in the book.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting because, like I said, the book is take questions. Like I said, the book is about me and not about me, but so much of the stuff that's about me is really about my sons. It's about fatherhood. It's about grappling with, like, I'm a different person. I wrote my memoir 10 years ago, and I think about it, and sometimes I read from it now, and I just think, how much I've changed. You know, I've been married for 11 years. We've lived in multiple states. We've gone on vacations. I mean, we've had joy touch our lives. And a lot of that has also been circumscribed by sort of thinking about how to deal with prison and incarceration. And so this book is kind of centered on what it meant to have to deal with it and grapple with it. Hopefully something I write later will deal with all of the joy that has come with, you know, being a father, being a husband, but just being friends with really dope people.
I'm going to ask one more question, and you are welcome to come stand here at the microphone, and we'll take a few questions. And so my question is about these erasure poems in the book, right? There are four of those. I'll note in Mass Poetry, we did an erasure project and with getting people around the country, around the state, to submit these erasure poems, and we then bought ads on the T, on the MBTA, to display these erasure poems, and they rejected them as too political. And so I wanted, you know, there's not a lot of context on what.
Yeah, it's in the back, but I tell you.
I don't have it in the back.
Okay, you got a fake book. And that is not for resale. If he tries to sell you this, the book is hardback, you know. No. It's an organization called the Civil Rights Corps, and they filed lawsuits against different cities and localities because those places were incarcerating people because they couldn't afford to pay bail. And now a lawsuit is like 70 pages. I'm a lawyer. I'm not even trying to read a civil suit. A lot of times the complaint is just boring. It's just like kind of dry and technical, and it has no life. But what was frustrating me is there was this thing is like fighting for people's freedom. It was arguing that this is wrong to treat human beings this way. And how do you make that understood by the people who were being represented in the lawsuit? Like, how do you turn that thing into poetry? And so I took these 70-page lawsuits, and I turned them into poems between 4 pages and 10 pages long. And I redacted. Usually you think about redaction as getting rid of, as making sure that you can't see what is, like, above your pay grade, what is top secret, what is sensitive. I said, no, I'm going to redact with superfluous so that all that's left is this sort of distilled rage, or this distilled complaint, or this distilled assertion that this is how we're being treated as human beings. And then one of them is in Houston, that's the judge's response to the complaint that was filed, because I wanted you to understand what these judges were actually saying in the lawsuit. Like, one line is that people wanted to stay locked up to get off a drug addiction because they got 3 meals a day for health insurance. Like, what kind of human being must you be to say that somebody wanted to be in prison because they wanted shelter? And that's what you do, is keep them in prison because they wanted shelter. And that's your argument for why it's okay to keep them in prison. And so I wanted to present the judge's voice, because, you know, nobody reads these things. I mean, I was a federal law clerk. I hated reading them. read them 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. They would haunt me. And then after I finished, I would rip them up and I would throw them away and I would like make a whole routine of it because like some of the driest stuff in life. But with these poems, I wanted to turn it into art. So
they are brutal, I gotta say.
Man, prison is, they ain't nearly as brutal as prison.
Prison.
They ain't nearly as brutal as prison.
Do we have questions from the audience? If not, I'll keep going. Yeah, sure. Come up to the mic. Introduce yourself. Otherwise, I'll keep going.
I think that's really cool because, well, there is somebody else. I don't even know if this song is popular. I'm from Dorchester. I'll be very loud. I'm not like plugging myself. This is actually pertinent, but a few months ago, a poem that I use from the, it's from like a special counsel's document about Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor. And the poem ended up being called Pretty Man because that's where the address for the judge's office was. And so I was thinking a lot, especially hearing you talk about sort of this changing or this idea of the image of the felon. And with cultural moments sort of like Felon Bay, like is it Jeremy Meeks who got a modeling contract after his mugshot went viral, and even right here in Boston with the kind of, not the changing face of a felon, but you know, you're seeing guys in like really nice men's warehouse suits who formerly worked at City Hall who are now felons. Like, how sort of are you observing kind of this, not necessarily a change, but more of a challenge to the image of a felon? Because I was going to ask you about that, like reading the copy in here. I was like, well, damn, he really calling himself a felon. I mean, that's your choice, but like, and I'm curious of how, in the larger cultural context, how are you exploring the kind of the, I guess just.
Yeah, I get it. But that, I mean, I don't know if it's changed as much as we think it might have, friends in prison.
Yeah.
And I think part of this is to say that a person could have been incarcerated and struggle in all the ways that everybody else struggles. I mean, if I change the title of the book to housekeeper or to, you know, teacher or to father, everything else in the book still stands.
Yeah.
And what I would like to believe is that if you read the book, it's not that you change your definition or understanding of a felon, but that you recognize, like what's captured in the book is the way you understand what it means to be alive. And then if you really believe that, then what we get to in terms of a cultural moment or a political moment is like maybe we get some people out of prison.
Yeah.
It's maybe we think seriously about what it takes to reduce the prison population. I mean, we have a presidential primary going on right now, and there has not been a single legitimate question asked about prison reform to any of the candidates. Not a single legitimate question. And so, you know, what I think is, or what I hope is that we will push to the moment where this is at the center of conversation. Because we have a subset of the population that believes mass incarceration is a fundamental American problem. And I'm afraid that that subset of the population is increasingly approaching, you know, zero. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Even though it's like 1 million of us, even though it's 2 million of us, even though it's 10 million of us, it's increasingly beginning to feel like it's zero. If you compare that to healthcare, you know, if you compare that to the way that we think about healthcare in a sort of political conversations, or Syria, or any of the really other profound tragedies that we've recognized as being deserving the center of our attention, this just isn't one. So, I don't know.
Cool.
Anybody else? Because
you mentioned prison reform. What are sort of your impressions of now? What kind of living in a world where if you were someone was seeking prison reform, they'd be almost more successful if they went through someone like Kim Kardashian.
That's not necessarily true. And I think that we should acknowledge that, like, Kim Kardashian, what she's really doing is funding the work of, like, 2 brilliant black women who started an organization to fight for clemency for people that's currently incarcerated. And so I think what we should acknowledge is that, yes, she has been successful, but she has been successful as the conduit of funds. And maybe what should depress us is that there aren't more, like, you know, celebrities or millionaires who are deciding to do that kind of work with that. But I think that, you know, prison reform, I mean, it's like you think about it on a broad scale, and the First Step Act was really significant, but you think about it that it really has to happen on a state level.
Yeah.
And different states have had profound reform that has made, like, huge changes in people's lives. California might have had the most. I mean, the issue I think about a lot is how juveniles get treated. And so California has reduced the age for you to be eligible for parole. For a long time, people weren't being paroled. I think the Virginia Parole Board just put Kimber Smith, who, if you remember, in the early 90s, her boyfriend was a drug dealer. She refused to turn in a boyfriend because she didn't really know anything about it anyway. He ended up committing suicide at an Atlanta airport, I think. But Kimber got like 130 months or something, and she got pardoned by Bill Clinton. But now she's on the parole board in Virginia. The parole board in Pennsylvania has somebody that's formerly incarcerated on it. The parole board in Connecticut had one. You got fools like me who got appointed by the governor of Connecticut to hire prosecutors. Why I'm hiring prosecutors is beyond me. It's like I'm just like courting failure or something.
I don't know. I can guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, I got my reasons, but I'm just saying that like it's different ways to imagine reform. But even saying all of the things that I've just mentioned, that hasn't necessarily led to less people being in prison. You know, you talk about Krasner, you talk about the DA out here in Boston that's doing great work. I mean, you have all of these sort of rivulets that really matter. But what I'm arguing, I hope, is to say, what does it mean? I mean, look, every debate has a conversation about healthcare. And I think that is serious and that is important. And so one of the things I'm thinking about is what is it? You know that that's in the center of concern for Democratic candidates running for president because of the way it's situated, not just by them, but also by the press. And so my question becomes, how do we situate a conversation about incarceration and decarceration in the same way? And I think that why it's really profoundly challenging and difficult to do that is because the fundamental baseline of incarceration for most people in every state prison in the country is that they've harmed somebody. And so, like, mass incarceration sounds like something that's really great to throw out in the air, but then when somebody steals your car, you call in the police, and like, yeah, it's them little knuckleheads from down the street, and one of them need to be locked up, and I want my car. You know, and so it's like, we need to figure out how to have a conversation that's really challenging that forces us to ask how do we deal with harm in a different way. Any of the conversations about incarceration aren't about dealing with harm. Those conversations are about nonviolent drug offenders and like people on death row. And that's not to diminish those concerns, but the weight of it all is not there. Those are sort of at the margins. Yeah. The weight of it is in a really uncomfortable center. If I got locked up today in Virginia, the judge would sentence me to the same amount of time. I would get the same 9 years in prison. I would be facing the same life sentence. The judge would not expect me to graduate from Yale Law School. That's just like a fundamental truth. And nobody got hurt physically hurt, no. Emotionally hurt, sure. Psychologically traumatized, I'm sure. Having a gun pulled on you is a horrific thing. So I'm sure about that. But in terms of like physically hurt, he wasn't physically hurt. And the state didn't do anything to help him address all of the things that he was struggling with. The state said, listen, this is how we're going to make you feel better. We sending this dude 5'5", 125 pounds, to prison. And they'll clap. And they clapped in the audience. Justice was served. And that's what will happen today. So I mean, I know that's I said both things. You know, we're in a moment that's really significant and it's showing real push towards reform. But we also in a moment that shows us unwilling to like grapple with what it's going to take to make this matter as much as healthcare matters, you know.
Thank you.
Just because I can hear you. The thing about the microphone for everybody, right? Like I can hear you, but we should never assume that everybody in the room can hear us unless your name is Barry White.
I wanted to know, you mentioned that when you started in prison, you knew you had a decade and you thought, who do I want to be when I come out? How did you come to poetry? What made you want to be a writer?
I've read a lot of books and it doesn't take money to become a writer. I had no real recourse. I mean, I had no real reason. I love books. I knew I loved books. I said I wanted to be something and I just decided to be a writer. I mean, I didn't know any. It's so strange, right? Prison, in which you would think possibility would be completely removed from my landscape, created without resources, without knowing anybody who was a writer. If you would have said an MFA program, what is an MFA program? You know, If you'd have said, if you said, Dwayne, what kind of writer do you want to be? I'd have been like, I don't know. And that might have just discouraged me right there. But I just said, I'm going to be a writer. And then when I was writing essays for my class for high school, to finish high school, I considered that being a writer. I started keeping a lukewarm, warm, horrible journal and considered that being a writer. And then a few years later, I was in solitary confinement for 6 months. And I got this book by Dudley Randall called The Black Poets. And I read Etheridge Knight's poetry for the first time. And he had been in prison. And I'm like, this dude is a poet. He'd been to prison. I'm going to be a poet. And then I just decided to be a poet. And so, you know, and that sounds like really whimsical. But I also feel like, you know, where I grew up at, we didn't encourage people. I decided to go to law school sitting in the cafeteria because a woman said, yeah, I finished my MFA and I decided I wasn't done with school. So I was like, should I get a PhD in English or should I go to law school? Mind you, we at Harvard Law School, and this is a black woman. And she's talking about, so I was like, should I get a PhD in English or should I go to law school? I just figured I'd go to law school. And I'm sitting there, right, thinking, what? People can make decisions like that? I was like, I'm going to law school. And it's like really, really strange, though, that like some of us get encouraged from when we like wee babies that be like, you could do anything you want, and I'm going to encourage it, even if I have no idea what that means. And some of us grow up in communities where they constantly tell you, you can't do anything. And it's wild that I was in prison and was just like, yeah, I'll be a writer. And I can say 20 years later, I mean, I've published 4 books. Nobody in my family's a writer. You know, it's like, it's kind of cool to me. Got time for one more question. Oh, my bad.
No, go ahead.
Do it again. Go, because I took his job.
No, it's good. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to Boston again and being here in front of us. Huge fan. I follow you on Facebook. My name is Shirley. I'm an educator. And one of the things I always try to keep up with the news and bring that to my students here in Boston. One of the things I've been seeing in the news the last few months about prisons across the country banning certain books, I wanted to get your take on that. And secondly, I was curious also to get your views on allowing people that are incarcerated for whatever crime or whatever, being still allowed to vote, because there's millions of us in prison and we can't vote. But I know certain states are moving towards allowing prisoners to vote. So those are my 2 questions. Thank you.
Yeah, that's good. That's 2 complicated questions. I mean, so I would do the censorship question is complicated mainly because one of the things I want to study is administrative law, and mostly because it's like a mess in a sense that the same way that every school in Boston has a principal and they have some rubric of things that must happen, but there are some things that the principal absolutely controls, and it differs from school to school, right? The way that they approach that subject, I mean, that issue, it might be dress code. It could be anything, right? Well, prisons work the same way, and that's why censorship is such a challenging topic. Because first, like I sent a book into prison, and it had a naked dude on the cover, right? It was Donnell Smith book. And they said it was porn. Right. And I was like, that ain't even good porn. Get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? It was like a picture, you know the famous picture of the white dude that's naked with his genitals out? But instead of it being a white dude that's naked, like lounging like this, it was like a black guy that was in the same, you know, but it was like, it wasn't porn, you know, it was like, and it was censorship, but it was just absurdity. And then I sent another book in, it was like A Brief History of 7 Killings. And they said, 7 killings? Are they people here? And they put it on the banned list. And then somebody read it, and 3 months later, they gave it to them. So again, this ends up being like a prison-to-prison thing. And what you realize, too, is that in a whole sense, so there's multiple ways to think about this. We could just sort of condemn the system, which that should be our rule, to just condemn the system. But if we want to think like seriously about censorship, we should ask questions about who is involved with these decisions.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I hire prosecutors, and I really don't like people going to jail. So they've included me in making this decision that, like, I really don't like doing at all. And you could imagine librarians don't want books to ever be censored. But you can see why certain things, like, If a book escaped prison in 5 steps, like The Dummy's Guide to Escape in Prison, I would think that maybe that should be censored, unless it was like the title was a metaphor and it was talking about meditation. Then maybe it shouldn't be censored, right? But so that's complicated. And I think the way that we could deal with that, though, is having a more active relationship with the institutions around us, sending books into prisons. I'm creating a paperback version, a prison edition of this book, and I'm doing a prison book tour, a sort of one book for those incarcerated. Because if you go to college, they're going to have a book that they just give you, and they're going to have writers coming in and talk to you. But, you know, when I was in prison 8.5 years, I never saw somebody come in to talk, you know, just to kick it. And I think that that's like a sort of profound thing. And I think this book raises a range of issues that allow us to talk more than just about incarceration, about fatherhood and all of those things. And there's a second question about voting, I think it's more complicated. I would say as a baseline rule, everybody should be able to vote once they get out of prison. And specifically soon as they get out of prison, because right now a lot of states say, like when I got out in Maryland, you could vote when you got off of probation. But if we have a system that says, okay, I'm not going to give you 10 years, I'm going to give you 2 years and 5 years of probation, why shouldn't I be able to vote for those 5 years? And you don't want to, so it's like, I think that as a baseline, you should be able to vote as soon as you come home. In Maine and Vermont, you can vote while you're locked up. Other states, you can't. I think that should you be able to vote while you're in prison? I think that that's a harder question. I guess I would say yes, but I think it gets complicated because, and I would say yes, right? But first it gets complicated because some states, they count you as being a resident of the community where you're incarcerated. And so then if you were actually able to vote, you'll be voting for people within that community, right? But I think that you should be able to vote while you're in prison, not because I think that your vote will necessarily have a huge impact on the election. I mean, in some states, it very well may, and that would just force candidates to deal with the prison. The reason why we're not talking about incarceration in the campaign is because we're not a voting bloc. All of these dudes with felonies in New York and felonies in, like, Boston, Massachusetts, and, like, you know, D.C., they're not a voting bloc because they can't vote. So I think if you were able to vote even while you were in prison, then maybe the circumstances would matter to those who are making decisions about your life. Thank you, guys. Time.
I got one last question. I want to know what you're reading.
We don't follow rules.
What are you reading now?
Oh, so I'm going to tell you this story, and then I'm going to say this publicly, and then I'm going to leave it alone for the next 2 hours. So at Georgia Southern, there was a writer named, I can't remember her name, so I'm not going to say her name, but she wrote this book. It was a novel. She was invited there for the first year experience. So she was doing a question and answer, and her book was about whiteness and about the difficulties and challenges of a student of color going through a predominantly white institution. And afterwards, the Q&A, a white student said, well, what gives you the right to come here and then sort of generalize about white people this way? And she said, I was invited here. You know, and your white privilege is what allows you to say a question like that. And then they went outside and burned the books. Now, I'm on the side of the students who burned the books. I am fully on the side of the students who burned the books. I have been invited to first year experience programs. She probably got paid more than anybody at that school's family made in 2 days than their family members make in a month. I think it's righteously obnoxious to tell somebody that your whiteness indicts you. But I don't know you. I don't know how you suffer. I don't know if you practice anti-racism. Like saying that somebody is condemned because of their whiteness is just like an absurdity. And 10 fucking media outlets picked up this story. The only one that talked to the students was BuzzFeed. For a minute, I wished I had married a white woman so that my rage would be like really, really pure. So that I could be like, my white kid, fuck you mean my white kid is a problem. By birth, that is like an absurdity, right? And the woman graduated from Cornell. That's like me coming to fucking like any random ass law school where you can't even get a job after you graduate. You went there because you really wanted to be a lawyer. You some young white student. And I say, yeah, your privilege is what makes you question me. No, I thought we were a part of encouraging people to ask questions. That doesn't mean you're right. That just means you got a right to ask a question. And I got a right to answer it. But what I'm reading, and this is how it connects, because you thought I was just using this as an opportunity to rant. That's not what I was doing.
I'm reading, well, that's always welcome.
I'm reading Ibram, Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. And in chapter 10, he talks about anti-white racism, and he defines it as when you take the behaviors and use it to characterize and condemn the entire white population. And he argues that that is just as fucked up as when people take the actions of some black folks and use it to characterize all black folks and to generalize to all black folks. And I've seen it happen. Because when I carjacked somebody, everybody in my neighborhood was a potential carjacker. Nobody was like a likely Yale candidate anymore if you grew up in Suitland because of what I did. And it was the same way when a friend of mine got murdered and my teachers just decided that I was going to die too because somebody that was close to me got killed for selling drugs. She generalized from what his experience was and assumed that that's how I was moving in the world. So that's the book I'm reading. That's my rant about Judge Southern. And I only make the rant because nobody else is making the rant. Everybody I know, super liberal, smart writers, readers, they all piling on. They call these kids Nazis. Fuck you gonna call a kid a Nazi for burning a book from an author that they just was mad at? If that kid is a Nazi, then I know I deserve the life sentence. You can't have it both ways. You can't be against mass incarceration and you calling a child a Nazi because they got upset with a writer and burned their book in outrage. They could be absolutely wrong for burning a book, but to be a Nazi, get the thing. That's made me so mad. Anyway, thank you guys.
Buy the book. He's going to sign. He's signing books. Buy the book.
Thanks. That was great.